Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. Coming up on this Monday edition, the Supreme Court has two major cases that they're going to hear. We have details about that. Also, New York 8th graders are failing Common Core math tests at pretty high numbers. Grant's got that story for us. Also, Russians were asked to name the greatest historical figure of all time. You might be surprised by who they chose. That and more coming up on this Monday edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Thanks for joining us there. You can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to at kpcgfm, and also any emails you'd like to send, send those to comments at kpcg.fm. This is a Monday edition. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, back in the saddle again. You were out of town for a week, had some business to attend to, but you're back. Good to see you.
Yeah, and I got to go to a Dodgers game while I was gone in L.A., so.
Nice.
Not all business. You know, I had a couple of enjoyable things to do, too.
There's a new term for that. It's called, I forget what it's called, like, bleisure? Or
business and pleasure.
Yeah, that's what it's
mixed.
Yeah, it's bleisure.
Bleasure.
Bleasure. Yeah, you had a bleasure trip. So, well, great. I think the Dodgers are doing pretty well, too, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I think they've won maybe something like 10 in a row, depending on how they did yesterday.
Yeah. So that's good. Well, we're glad to have you back. The we weren't able to talk about all the important sports things that were happening while you were gone.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Well, tonight the NBA is hosting its first annual official awards show in New York City. Usually they give the awards out much earlier. This year they wanted to make an event out of it, I guess, to make more money. The event begins at 9 p.m. Eastern on TNT. And the reason we're interested in it, I guess, as Thunder fans, is that Russell Westbrook, I'm assuming, is going to win the MVP. If he doesn't, it'd be a shame, I believe.
Yeah, hopefully he does. He had a tremendous season, obviously, with the triple doubles, at least 10 points, 10 rebounds, 10 assists. He averaged that high level for those categories the entire season. That's pretty incredible. I've never even really come close to a double-double playing in my life at a much lower level of competition.
Well, and those triple-doubles, it wasn't like he just got 10 points. I mean, he was getting, well, I think he led the league in scoring, didn't he? 30-something a game. So.
Yeah.
Had a great year by a lot of measures. And it's an individual award, obviously. So we'll see if he wins that tonight. We'll be excited if he does. And if he doesn't, they'll be hearing from me.
Do you think we would riot in Oklahoma City? I can't really see it.
No, I don't think so, but people would definitely be upset. Also, the NBA draft was last week. What did you think about that? What do you think about Lonzo Ball going number two to the Lakers?
Well, I actually really like his dad because he's a strong father figure and he has all of his sons in line. None of them are getting in trouble off the court. And basically, it seems like he spoke it into existence, his son playing for the Lakers. So it worked out pretty well that his son will be a professional basketball player something like 30 miles away from where the whole family lives.
Yeah, it's really neat. They did a lot of training growing up in their backyard. They had a court kind of set up, and their dad would run them through some drills and things. So really a phenomenal player in a lot of ways. I like watching him. I haven't seen him a lot, but I'm looking forward to seeing him play this year. And so it'll be interesting to see how all those guys do. It's always funny when you look back in 5 years at the draft and some people came in with a lot of fanfare and then you don't even remember who they are. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's hard to make it on a professional level.
Yes, and I think some teams got blasted depending on what their pick was or what type of trade they tried to make. The poor Chicago Bulls got rid of Jimmy Butler on a draft night trade, and so they were heavily criticized for doing that. I think the Philadelphia 76ers traded from the third pick in the draft to the first pick, and as far as I can tell, it didn't actually change who was going to be picked by the other teams. Hmm. So it's not like their guy would have been taken if they hadn't had the first pick already.
Sometimes it seems like people just, general managers feel like they need to make a change.
Yeah.
Even if it's not really a good one. They just feel like it has to change.
Just so much pressure. And obviously those guys who got drafted are going to have a lot of pressure too. It's a big difference playing in college from playing in the NBA. Although in college, probably the defense is a little bit tougher to deal with because they play a lot harder defense.
As a team, probably. Yeah. I think with the NBA, they're just such phenomenal athletes that the guy guarding you is no longer 6'3". He's now 6'8".
Right.
Makes it harder. Some of the headlines today, pretty interesting. Supreme Court's had a big day. There's two big stories or cases that they're going to take up in the fall. But it says Trump travel ban. Supreme Court reinstates key parts of executive order. And this just happened last little bit here. It says the Supreme Court on Monday said it would allow the Trump administration's controversial travel ban to largely go into effect while setting a hearing on the entire executive order for October. So it's kind of happening, except they'll obviously look at it then in October again. The court's decision means the justices will now wade into the biggest legal controversy of the Trump administration, Trump's order temporarily restricting travel from six Muslim-majority countries. He's tried to instate that several times. Local judges have overturned it, and now the Supreme Court reinstates key parts of it until they can look at the full thing coming up in October.
Yes, and what has been lost in a big part of this story is that, really, they have not been allowed to block any of it, really. None of these judges should have been blocking it, but they have turned out to be activist judges. It's completely constitutional for the president to take national security measures without the courts trying to get in the way of that. And yet it seemed like the judges were looking to score political points from the other side by blocking some parts of this. So at least the Supreme Court realized that what the president was doing is okay. And it's really a temporary thing. It's something that is supposed to help increase the vetting process and hopefully increase the security quality of the borders and of just the ability for people to come into the country.
It'll be interesting to see people's reactions. I think a lot of people will be quite pleased. The loudest people will probably be not pleased, the ones out there that'll be doing things, I would imagine. We'll see how it goes as the day progresses. But, you know, there's a lot of, pretty fanatical rhetoric against these type of bans, you know, all kinds of accusations and all kinds of name-calling, when in reality it's just a temporary hold to vet people, to make sure that they're not coming in as terrorists. And that seems pretty logical, pretty reasonable.
The ironic part of this whole issue is that what Mr. Trump did with the travel ban is actually spurred protesters to go into airports and block people from traveling in and out. And so it's pretty much like they're enforcing his travel ban.
Yeah. We'll show you. We'll ban you as well. Sometimes it's just hard. You know, people get upset and they want to protest, but sometimes they don't think the protest through and then they actually are doing what they're protesting. So it can get kind of weird that way. Another case that the Supreme Court agrees to hear is going to be really interesting. It's going to be the religious liberty case. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a religious liberty case concerning a Colorado cake artist. That's what they call them now. They used to be bakers, but now they're cake artists. The artist formerly known as the cake artist, who refused to make a cake for a same-sex couple's wedding reception. This has been in the news of several places, claiming that to do so violated his religious liberty under the Constitution. The court will take up the case, Masterpiece versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission, in its next term, which starts in October. That'll be fascinating to see what they come out with. We've seen that happen. It was up in Oregon, was it? There was another story like that. The homosexuals versus the bakers. It's such a weird thing to think about, but it is happening, and the Supreme Court's going to weigh in.
Yes, and what's also kind of an intriguing aspect of this is that you know there are other religions that would not bake a cake for a homosexual couple as well. It's not just Christians. I saw an undercover video where a guy went into a Muslim bakery and he asked to get the same thing. He pretended to be a homosexual and asked to get a cake baked for his wedding. And of course they said no as well. Why is there not more attention on that? It's being pinpointed down to Christian bakers, which it makes you wonder what the whole motive of that is and why they're only targeting one specific religion.
Yeah, it's going to be a fascinating case. It reminds me sort of this another very famous case that happened years ago, 1925, the Scopes trial, which was the evolution versus creation, basically. It was formerly known as the State of Tennessee versus John Thomas Scopes, hence the title, the Scopes trial, or it's known as the Scopes Monkey Trial. It was an American legal case in which a high school teacher, Scopes, was accused of violating Tennessee's Butler Act, which had made it unlawful to teach human evolution in any state-funded school. So it was a really, it was a battle of creation versus evolution. And so they went to trial. And this was a big thing. A lot of people came and a lot of media came to see it. They found Scopes guilty because he wasn't supposed to teach it, and he did. But the bigger issue was the two attorneys that went after it. William Jennings Bryan, he was a three-time presidential candidate, argued for the prosecution. Clarence Darrow, who was a famed defense attorney, he spoke for Scopes. They had this battle, and it was a battle of religion, modernists versus the fundamentalists. The modernists believed in this atheistic evolution, like, well, maybe God used evolution. The fundamentalists said no, they didn't agree with that. And so what happened was there was this big, well, they called Jennings Bryan as a witness, which is unusual because he was the attorney. But the defense called him as a witness. And by this point in the case, there were so many people there, they had to take it outside because they were afraid the courthouse was going to collapse. And so Darrow, who was the defense attorney, he grilled William Jennings Bryan for 2 hours on the Bible to try to make him look like an idiot. And some by a lot of accounts, he succeeded. He asked him all sorts of questions about Adam and Eve and where did Cain's wife come from? And did the sun really stand still? And did Jonah really get swallowed by a large fish? And he grilled him on all of these things. And unfortunately, Jennings Bryan didn't know his Bible all that well. He got stumped. And a lot of people would, even if they probably knew their Bible pretty well, if you're going to just get grilled for 2 hours. And so the whole point of that was to try to make people that would believe in the Bible look like idiots. You know, oh, you don't understand anthropology. You don't understand science. You can't prove this. You can't prove that. And in a lot of ways, even though they lost the trial, they were successful in making people that actually believed the Bible look stupid. And so when I think about this next case coming up, this the bakeries versus the homosexuals, I just wonder if they're going to take that same sort of line, like modernist thinking versus the Bible, because that's what it's coming down to.
Well, that's a trend too, isn't it? That you try to just make the opposition look dumb instead of actually presenting the facts and the evidence to prove the case. It doesn't sound like Darrow was really presenting too much evidence against what the Bible said, but if you just keep on rambling about what the Bible says and force him to defend it the entire time and not be able to ask any questions back, it's really a tough position to try to defend all of that, especially when you're up there for 2 hours. That is, there's a tiredness factor, there's a pressure factor, and even sometimes when you do know the answer, it's tough to do it in front of people for that long. But that is really what you see from the radical left a lot of the time, is that they don't even make an attempt to try to substantiate their viewpoints or their arguments. They just go on the attack and try to basically attack you personally. They're not even attacking your beliefs as much as they are attacking your character or your intelligence level or whatever else it might be.
Yeah, and in the case of that Scopes trial, I think Jennings Bryan wanted to then put Darrow up on the stand, and the judge said, forget it.
Should have been able to.
And at the end of the 2 hours, they were actually like standing up screaming at each other because they were so enraged, both of them. And then Jennings Bryan, he didn't get a chance to really defend himself. He died, I think, 5 days later.
Wow.
So, and the media that was there was very liberal, very modernist, and they reported on it like, oh, he just got completely embarrassed. Even though it didn't totally go that way, you could have reported it a different way, but that was the narrative that the media threw out there. So it's a famous trial for a lot of reasons, but it did make people that would believe in the Bible and what the Bible teaches look like wild-eyed hillbillies, as they say in some of the write-ups about it.
And we see that all the time now, just the way that people think of the Bible. A lot of people are borderline ashamed to even admit that they believe everything the Bible says. Well, they'll say, you know, that's an allegory, or that is a metaphor. That doesn't necessarily mean it happened. You know, the Red Sea didn't necessarily part, even though we've actually seen archaeological findings at the bottom of the sea that would say that it did happen. But what when so many people are saying it's ludicrous to even believe what the Bible has in it, you're going to start either being quiet about it or being more ashamed about it, or kind of weakening your stance on a lot of those issues so that you don't get ridiculed. That's just the natural human tendency to avoid sticking out so much that you're scorned for it.
Yeah. So it's going to be a fascinating case. This is coming up this, I guess it's in October. Supreme Court agrees to hear the religious liberty case. I would imagine the Bible wouldn't be brought up. Well, maybe it would. I mean, it's a religious case. I don't know. But that's a hard thing to bring up in court.
Yeah.
I just don't. It's just, it seems like that ship has sailed as far as the legal world is concerned.
You can kind of already imagine some of the questions they might ask to those bakers. You know, would you bake a cake for anyone if they might have sinned in any way in their entire lives?
Sure.
Are you really going to single out this one supposed sin and not bake for these people? Well, that's, you know, that's an easily answerable question, but when people are pressured like that, it's going to be tough to answer.
Yeah, it really is, and it's going to set a precedent for what people have to do going forward. So it's going to be very interesting. Here's another write-up. This is from Fox News. North Korean horror. Newly exposed video reveals brutal tactics of Otto Warmbier's sadistic tortures. So the video is not of him, but it's of North Korea and how they do some of their interrogations, so you can extrapolate that they probably use the same things on Mr. Warmbier. They say many detainees are tortured into confessing crimes they didn't even commit. And if you see the video, it's on Fox. You know, if you're getting beaten, yeah, you'd probably, you know, say anything to get out of it. So that's what they do. They say this is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the treatment of inmates inside Kim Jong-un's torture chambers and prison camps. The brutality of the North Korean regime was once again cast into the international spotlight following the death of 22-year-old American student Otto Warmbier last week. Doctors said the University of Virginia student had suffered severe brain damage, which doctors said was likely due to cardiopulmonary arrest suffered while in North Korean detention. North Korea tried to say he had botulism. They didn't see any evidence of that. My guess would be he was tortured into a coma and then died.
What was outstanding about it, too, was that a lot of the people with knowledge of the situation were extremely restrained and diplomatic in what they would say about the North Korean regime. They didn't really make too many accusations of torture, really, but it's not too hard to imagine what must have been happening to that kid over there, especially I saw both of his high school commencement speech and his confession from January of last year. And when you contrast those, he seems like a pretty tough, well-rounded guy in the commencement address, someone with a good knowledge of reality. But then when you look at his confession, he's wailing. It's almost just sad and pathetic. He's a totally different person who clearly must have been coerced into admitting something like that, saying, you know, I'm so sorry. I did steal this banner or whatever it was and try to hide it to take back as a souvenir. He was coerced into doing that, and they must have done some horrible things to him. But people are not really too willing to think about that, because then how does America respond? If he was tortured, you have to do something pretty big about it.
Yeah, and he, the video of him pleading his case, I guess, he blamed the U.S. administration and all this. And
right.
You've seen, I mean, we've all seen that happen with people that have been taken captive, and they're obviously under threat or duress, and they make all these accusations against the United States. Because, of course, the United States would tell you to go steal a poster. You know, obviously, I'm not trying to make light of it, but I mean, clearly he's under duress to say mm-hmm. those things. So it's probably not a surprise that that's happening in North Korea, but this ties into another story that you sent along, Grant. From the American Spectator, it says, not all Americans are grieving for Otto Warmbier. You would think everybody would be on the same page here. Now, first of all, I don't think it's smart to go there because of what's going to happen to you potentially. I don't know what the guy did or didn't do, but he didn't do anything to deserve the torturous treatment that he got. that's just the brutal, perverted regime over there. And it seems like if there's one thing Americans could agree on, it would be that. That's, I mean, aren't we the beacon here of human rights and all of this in the United States? Well, not in everybody's estimation. The American Spectator, again, says not all Americans are grieving for Otto Warmbier. They write, almost immediately after news broke that Otto had died, Catherine Detweiler, an adjunct professor of anthropology at the University of Delaware, signed onto her Facebook account. Everyone's getting in trouble with the social media. The things you just would muse in private, now it's in public. She asked this, is it wrong of me to think that Otto Warmbier got exactly what he deserved? Really, exactly what he deserved? She went on to deride this dead kid as spoiled, naive, and arrogant. I mean, did she know him? I don't think she had any idea about him. And the writer here in the piece says, that is despicable, but apparently Detweiler felt the need to reach a broader audience than Facebook, so she waded into the comments box on National Review, where she wrote, Otto is typical of the mindset of a lot of young, white, rich, clueless males who come into my classes. So she's got it all figured out and took this opportunity to attack a dead young man killed by the dictatorial regime in North Korea.
Yeah, that professor apparently styles herself as an expert on white males, and that whenever they're in college, they are all probably rapists, drug addicts, and think they're above the law. That's really how she generalized Otto Warmbier in her posts.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's unbelievable that you could marginalize an entire section of society like that. We talk about stereotypes and how really supposedly offensive they are, especially if they're directed at a minority group or a supposedly oppressed group. But it's totally fine if you do it toward a white male.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Another commenter on the National Review took her on, reproaching her for her, quote, hatred that you spew at ordinary white college kids. But the professor loaded up with a full tank of venom, they write, and not an ounce of shame, wasn't backing down. She attacked Otto as one of those, quote, white, rich, clueless males who think nothing of raping drunk girls at frat parties and snorting cocaine, cheating on exams, and threatening professors with physical violence. Where is she teaching? What kind of a college is this? Now, you can take any segment of the population, and you might find a few people that would be extreme or out there. But it's funny how people that are not, in this case, a white male, are the experts. I am a white male. I feel like maybe I would have some say. You're going to have people that do crazy things of every, you know, origin, race, age group, whatever. But this is not the time, like this situation, certainly not the time for her to say things like this. And then she went after the parents. She said his parents ultimately are to blame for his growing up thinking he could get away with whatever he wanted. And of course, it's Otto's parents who will pay the price for the rest of their lives. Wow-wee. I mean, she really exposed herself in her thinking. That's pretty, it's cruel. It's there's no compassion there, and certainly not a lot of wisdom either.
And it certainly was a mistake for Otto to go over there to North Korea for a tour, but it's somewhat understandable because there is almost like a morbid curiosity about what's happening over there, or somewhere like Iran, where they're so closed off from the rest of the world that you almost just want to see what is happening.
Yeah.
And I went through a phase where for a couple of weeks I was really interested in what was happening in North Korea. I did not take the step of going there myself, but I tried to find things online. And sure enough, the only thing I could really find was the national website with its propaganda. So a lot of the time, if you really, really want to know about a country like that, you actually have to go there yourself. And it's one of those cases where you don't think anything could ever happen to you. Maybe you've heard of a freak accident or a tragedy on the news, but you certainly don't think you're going to be the victim.
Yeah. So it's a tragic event that happened. And no matter what happened with the fellow from America here, Otto Warmbier, clearly North Korea is a dictatorial regime. They're terribly cruel to the people that live there, whether they're quote-unquote criminals or not, or they're treated as criminals. Even just the normal people that are just living there, they're treated in terrible ways. The whole country is pretty much a concentration camp. There's stories coming out about how people are killed even within the administration. It's clearly wrong. It is clearly evil. And then to have somebody that's a college professor in the United States come out and sort of make it like, well, you know, got what you deserved. It just shows some of the thinking. Some of the thinking, not everybody, but some of the thinking that's at those universities. Would you want this as a professor? Not if you're a white male, you don't.
Right. Well, here was a young man who just had a really strong desire to learn, and it did lead him down a dangerous path. But you could not say the same for those white males she is describing there. Those types of buffoons don't even know that North Korea exists.
Right.
So clearly, she should not be generalizing him like that when he was trying to explore the world and see what was going on in a dangerous nation like that.
Yeah. It's and it's funny. Well, anyway, there's a lot to say there, but I think it speaks for itself. Interesting note here that just a little factoid you might be interested in. Sometimes people talk about multitasking, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Well, people are doing it. 95% of people, they say, multitask on average for a third of the day. So if you're listening to the radio, you're probably multitasking right now. But radio is one of those things you can multitask with.
Our program is pretty good for that, too.
Sure.
You can listen to it, and we go from topic to topic. So if you don't like a topic, wait a couple minutes, and we'll go on to the next one.
We'll talk about something else. Just be patient. Just give us a break. So multitasking, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I'm getting a lot done, and other times I think I got a lot done, and then I realize I totally blew something. I didn't do what I was supposed to. So there are certain parts of my day where I really do need to stop and say, I need to focus on this, because if I don't, I'm going to make a mistake.
Multitasking is a really deceptive habit. It makes you think that you're getting more than one thing done at once, but really what you're doing is slowing the pace of both or however many activities it might be. You think you're getting things done, but really it's just kind of a placebo. It's something where you feel productive, but you're really not being productive.
I've seen people occasionally walking and reading a book, or I've seen people even riding a bike and trying to read. And I tried walking and reading a book one time. I just couldn't do it because I was too nervous about what I was going to walk into. And then I started to get sort of almost like motion sickness. I just get the motion in my peripheral vision, but it didn't work for me. So that's one thing that I've seen people do. And I thought, that's not a bad idea, but I couldn't do it.
That actually is a skill, because you have to hold the book high enough to where you can kind of see from the top of your vision over your book. Yeah. ahead of you to where you're going. If you're holding it too low, you really can run into buildings or, you know, into other people. So that's something where you kind of have to get used to that.
Maybe that's if you're single, maybe that's how you find your future spouse.
Oops.
You walk into each other when you're reading. Love is blind, right? They say. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here at 101.3 KPCG. Thanks for joining us today. Myself, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon here. Kia David program's coming up in a little bit. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Richard Palmer today from Ed Stone, England. Make sure you listen for that. Also, stop and check out thetrumpet.com. Top story today, Germany's Secret Service scandal. Vital background information about the organization that has been spying on the United States. That was in the news recently. Also, German Secret Service spied on the White House and the significance of Germany's break from America. You can find all of those at thetrumpet.com. And also, a good write-up from Abraham Blondeau, Churchill and defeating terrorism. Churchill waving the victory sign to the crowd at Whitehall on the day he broadcast to the nation that the war with Germany had been won. That's the caption under the photo there. And it says, critical lessons from history are being ignored. So really good write-up there from Abraham. And when he comes back in one of these days, he will talk to us about that, I'm sure.
We'll praise him for his great writing.
Yeah. He's on assignment doing some other things, but he is still trying to write, so we got out that piece. Grant, you've got a write-up here from Breitbart, and you're a math guy. A math wizard, as it were. New York eighth graders failing Common Core math tests tripled since the testing began. I know the solution, just stop testing them.
That's right, or make the test easier, which is what they're actually doing.
Oh, boy.
There are some pretty big issues here with the New York public schools. Back in 2012, those who failed the eighth grade math exams, there were still 14,000 who failed back in 2012. But most recently, 44,483 failed. So that's more than three times as many eighth graders who are failing a basic math exam. These are the types of exams that are not giving you the most advanced concepts that you have learned. They're going back a few months or even a year to stuff that you should have pretty well established in your math arsenal, and you should have been pretty much repeating those same concepts over the last year or so. Those are things you should really should know for a test.
Yeah, math is one of those subjects where you really have to build on past knowledge. And if you at some point in the process you struggle with something and you don't quite understand the concept, it's going to hurt you down the road. So this is a really bad sign, because you almost have to go back and start at the beginning at some point, or at least some beginning spot, to then catch up with the math that's being built on top of it.
Yes, and I was teaching a seventh and eighth grade class here at Imperial Academy on the campus, and it is a scary time for students, because this is the first grade where they start to think, well, I don't know if I understand this too well. At that point, you have two options. You can bear down and do the homework and ask a lot of questions and make sure that you get it, or you can sort of give up, and for the next 5 years of school, math is going to make you miserable.
Yeah, and it really is something that there's a lot of anxiety about math, which I think we've talked about. And it's not, I mean, for some people it is pretty natural and it comes very easily, and others it's a struggle. But like this article points out, I mean, we're not talking about just struggling, like, I pulled a C. We're talking about failing. Failing. And so a common core is something that there's been a lot of debate about. I don't know much about it other than I've heard about it in the news, and it's a curriculum that they're trying to get in some schools, or some schools have adopted, and yet there's been pushback against that. And apparently, and I haven't looked into it a lot, but from like stories like this, it appears that it's not helping. It's actually hindering the students, at least as far as the math is concerned.
Right. From what I understand about Common Core, that is basically administered by the federal government, which means that if you have, you know, some sort of political ideologue in that department, they could really be influencing what every student across the country is learning if Common Core stays in place. If you get rid of that, then education is localized, and it's a lot harder to corrupt the entire student population in the country. But what you're seeing with these sort of federal programs is a lowering of the bar, a lowering of standards. That's what a lot of people on the national level think is the best idea. For example, this Regents Common Core Algebra 1 exam that these students were taking, you have to earn just 27 of the 86 points on the test. That's 31.4%. That's passing.
Wow.
And that's all it takes.
And they still failed it.
Yes.
Oh, wow. I was crazy me. I was thinking it was like, you know, you had to have better than a 60.
Right.
Wow. You have, not only have you failed, you are an abject failure.
Right.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah, it's really disturbing that they're lowering it so much. The last couple of years, it used to be 36%, then 34.9% for passing. Now it's 31.4%. You see the trend. They're just going to keep on lowering the bar if they don't think enough students will pass. They're trying to make sure everyone graduates, regardless of if they can barely read a sentence or if they can barely add two simple numbers together. They just want to get them through the system and out into the real world, completely incapable of dealing with the real world.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. I mean, I guess, yeah, where would you eventually would come to the point where you just, well, give it your best shot and congratulations. You know, it'd be like a participation pass.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you showed up and, you know, so we'll pass you. But even if you pass and you move on, and but you're only understanding enough to get a 40% right, which you could almost guess,
right,
and get that. I mean,
oh, yeah.
As long as, you know, if you had just a basic understanding, you could probably guess your way to that. Because I don't know exactly what they're teaching at this level. I guess some basic algebra, things like that.
Find what X equals.
Yeah.
It's really not much.
So if they're giving you points based on your work, like maybe you get the wrong answer, but yeah, they give you a point for doing some step right, you could probably squeeze out 30% pretty easily.
Yeah, you would think so. And it's important to look at this from the aspect from the perspective of a student. If you're a student right now and you know that no matter what kind of work you produce, you're moving on. You're going to get out of school at the same time as all your students, all of your classmates who are getting a 95 or a 100%. Is that really motivating for you to do well? Or would the threat of failing the class and being ridiculed by those around you who think you're stupid now, that's actually kind of a sort of a good pressure to not be known as an idiot, which is really a motivation. It used to be whenever I was in school, that was a pretty big motivation for people to actually get a high enough grade to pass.
Yeah.
Now they're just lowering it so much that, well, you can be as dumb as you want to and you'll still pass.
Yeah, it gives people a, just an excuse. I mean, sometimes you do just have to work harder.
Right.
And really buckle down and do the best you can. And maybe you're not an A student, but you can at least, if you have a basic intelligence, you can at least work hard enough to get a passing grade, I would think, in most cases. Maybe you don't go to advanced math, but still, you get your basics in. So it is interesting. And it's so interesting, too, because there's such a emphasis on education in the U.S. and in the West, I guess, and higher education. Everyone needs to be educated. And yet, if you look at what's happening here, people are becoming less and less educated the more they talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's such a contradiction. Do they have any? Obviously, they want to improve this, right? They want the kids to do better. So, what are they hoping to do, or how are they hoping to accomplish improving their understanding of the math?
Well, some high-level officials within the teaching community say that this is a political decision. This is a way to get students through, even if they're failing, just to prevent facing the outrage of parents who inevitably will take their child's side and say, well, my child would never fail a class. This has to be your fault for not teaching them the right way. You know there's a lot of parents like that now, and so they're just trying to avoid wrath and move people through, stay away from controversy possibly. It doesn't really look like there are many solutions. It's just a matter of gaining favor with the parents.
Well, there's this idea out there too that some tests are bias. Like, you know, if you look at it and they say, well, look, hey, a certain segment of the population or a certain area of the country, they do better than this other area, well, there must be some inherent bias in there. Or could just be that they're working harder at it, or they come from a more stable background, or their parents make sure they do their homework. And again, that gets back to this, what we've seen really, well, it's been going on for quite some time, but particularly the last 8 years or so, where their main concern was equal outcome, not equal
opportunity. Right.
Right. And so no matter who you are, where you are, we'll pass all of you. We're going to have an equal outcome here, even though you haven't taken advantage of the opportunity.
That's just really, if you think about that, that is such a hopeless, discouraging way of viewing life, thinking that no matter what you do, there are always going to be people who are better than you just because of skin color or gender or whatever it might be. It doesn't matter how much work you put in. You're always going to be a victim. You're always going to be helpless and at the mercy of other people. That's really what they're teaching millions of people from a pretty young age, even through this type of testing standard and calling math racist and things like that. That's how they're teaching people to grow up and live their lives. And so how do those people grow up? They're going to become adults who think that the government owes them because they've been oppressed their whole lives. That means the welfare state's not getting any smaller. There are a lot of ramifications to that really destructive, poisonous way of thinking.
Yeah, you just look at the contrast in the thinking. If you want to talk about fairness and justice, you have a college professor who comes out and says Otto Warmbier got what he deserved by being beaten to death in North Korea. But then on the other hand, the educational system, or a lot of it, says, well, just let everybody pass. If you get a 30%, you get an F. You got what you deserved.
Right.
If you want to talk about getting what you deserve, if you do poorly or you don't put the work in, or if you just don't have the intelligence to do it, then you need to find some other path. But you do get what you deserve. You do reap what you sow.
Well, we are in an age where excuses are trendy and they are acceptable now. I don't know if you remember much of your schooling days, but the way I felt...
They weren't that long ago.
I knew that was going to sound that way. But you know how it was when you got an assignment from a teacher and there wasn't going to be an excuse. You either got it done or your teacher was upset with you and you just didn't want that to happen. It wasn't like, well, you know, I was at violin lessons or my family was driving in the car for several hours. You have to get it done. There's a due date. It has to be turned in by that time. There's no excuse for it. And the reason for that is if you just think every night that you're too busy, well, you're going to fall way behind the whole rest of the class. And the learning is going to be really extremely hindered.
We had teachers that were, some were pretty easily manipulated to where you could convince them to make an assignment easier, and others that you couldn't. And, it, you know, the ones that were a little more easily manipulated, I think for a while were sort of liked. But I know, I think for myself personally, and probably for the people in that class, at the end of it, we actually kind of ended up not caring for that teacher very much because they were just so weak. And they, oh, you can do it. You don't have to do it. There was a few like that. And you knew it would be a fairly easy grade, but you didn't get anything out of it. And while that might have been nice initially, at the end, I didn't respect those teachers like I did the ones that actually would hold you accountable. Were fair. You know, sometimes some didn't seem all that fair, but if they were fair, if they were hard but fair, I think those were the ones that people actually really liked at the end of the day. And that's really the education people need. It needs to be hard. It needs to challenge you. That's the point. If you go to class, you're supposed to be taught something you didn't know before. That's not easy, you know, but if it's hard but fair, I think that's the education people want, and that's what really helps them grow.
Exactly. And, so, you know, learning things you didn't know, taking in knowledge that you can use later on, that's something that people care about more than being able to sit around and play on their phone the entire class just because the teacher doesn't care what you do. It's always a lot more inspiring to be pushed to a level you never thought possible. Sometimes if you have a workload that you think is pretty big and maybe you need a late night or two to get it all done, but then you can sit back and relax and say, look what I just accomplished. I didn't think I could do this, but really, when you get rid of the excuses and you have to get it done and there's an urgency there, it feels great getting it accomplished.
Yeah. I mean, what's more fair or equitable for everybody? Is it to, you know, show them what they could do or what they could be, or is it to just make excuses so they never have to rise to the challenge? You know, I talk about like being unfair to certain segments of society. That's very unfair to hold. You want to talk about holding people down. If you refuse to make them put forth effort to grow and expand, that is holding them down.
Yes, and Ben Stein wrote a really interesting column for American Spectator pretty recently, and he was talking about how middle-class parenting has become treacherous almost because it is like you have to look over their shoulder at what they're doing, and you have to sit there for hours and guide them through their homework. And he was saying when he was younger, you had to know history, you had to know math, you had to know English. No one was there threatening you, saying you're not going to get into a good college if you don't do well on these things. Everyone just knew that, and so they put in the work. It has changed a lot where, you know, there has been a trend toward easier parenting techniques, and, you know, that's a whole different subject. But when you allow students to think that whatever they feel like putting into it is totally acceptable, then they're going to put in very little effort. If they think that the standard is really low, it's going to be a rare child who actually goes way beyond that standard.
Yeah, for sure. So that right up there is from Breitbart, New York eighth graders failing Common Core math tests tripled since the testing began and failing at like 30-some%. So, wow. sort of related to that, there's a write-up here from the Associated Press. Homeless college students, a growing concern on campuses. They say studies suggest thousands of students at community colleges nationwide could be considered homeless or precariously housed. That's a new term. I'm precariously housed.
Like on the edge of a cliff or something like that?
Yeah.
That's kind of what it sounds like.
Yeah, it's about to fall. Either because they have been thrown out of their house, they've been evicted, or sleep in a shelter, car, or abandoned building, yet somehow they're attending college. The few researchers who study the issue say there is scant data, but they believe a surprisingly large number of college students are homeless. In a lot of cases, it's because they are drug addicts, or they're trying to kick the habit. They have issues of some kind. There's a professor at Temple University in Philadelphia, Sarah Gottlieb Robb, recently released a homeless national survey taken at 70 community colleges across 24 states. And they said, they're the third study, and they find that 13-14% of the students are considered homeless or precariously housed. And all the reports all the studies have found those same numbers, so they think they're pretty accurate. 33,000 students surveyed said they were food insecure. I guess that means you're hungry. Why can't you just be hungry?
This is some fancy terms. We talked about a cake artist earlier.
Yes.
We're dressing up a lot of basic terms, it seems like.
The cake artist was precariously housed and food insecure.
It's what interesting now? Being a cake artist and food insecure.
He was an unemployed baker that was out of work and had nothing to eat and no place to live. So anyway, it's interesting that these people, some of these students, they're actually attending university. Now they're usually on some sort of a government handout to do that. But they don't have a job. They don't have nothing in their life says, I'm ready to go to college. I suppose the dream would be you get a degree and all of a sudden you turn it around. And there could be a situation like that or two. But in a lot of cases, they go through a couple of examples, drug addicts.
Mm-hmm.
Situations, really bad life decisions that have led them to this place. But they want to attend university. One of the commenters said, these students have their priorities all wrong. Get a job first, then get housing, then maybe considering being a part-time student. This is totally ridiculous. And I do think that is sort of true. It's the priorities are upside down. If you can't eat and you have no place to live, I don't think going to a university or a community college should be the first thing on your list.
Well, right? there was a frenzy about a decade ago in the media to talk about homelessness and how really, it just affects people who have worked really hard and they have tried so hard to make it in life, but yet circumstances beyond their control force them into homelessness. And yet when people actually looked at even the people they were interviewing on the news, those people all had drug problems. It was the majority of them making those types of decisions that are inevitably going to lead to disaster. That's the type of problem where you have to acknowledge the source. You can't just say, we have some people who are homeless and we need to provide them with affordable housing or free housing, whatever it might be. That's what usually the solution is from a lot of those people. They don't say kick the drug habit and then move on with your life. And especially going to college, the rent is, well, the tuition's expensive enough. Usually I think they try to do something for you so that you're not paying too much in rent, but drugs are expensive. And if you feel like paying for the drugs instead, you're not going to have the rent money anymore, and that's sort of what it leads to.
And that is the solution they're looking at is more government money, more federal handouts to make sure people have enough to eat and a place to stay, which is good. But you have to look at their choices up to that point. And how are they supposed to do well in school if they're, first of all, if they're drug addicts or recovering addicts? It does mess with your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have a place to live and nothing to eat. And what do you think they're going to be cramming over the, you know, preparing for the biology test the next day? They don't even, it just seems like it's backwards.
Well, college is a big decision to make because you know that probably you're going to have a part-time job that doesn't pay a whole lot. And you're going to be doing a lot of studying. So you're not going to have a whole lot of free time in a lot of cases. And so the money that you actually do make, you have to use it for constructive purposes. You don't have hundreds of extra dollars or thousands of extra dollars to be blowing on a vice like that.
Yeah, really interesting. One other story today. This is from Russia. Stalin tops Putin in Russian poll of greatest historical figures. Russians have picked Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin as the greatest figure in history. A new poll said on Monday, beating President Vladimir Putin into joint second alongside poet Alexander Pushkin. In the poll conducted in April, Russians were asked to pick the 10 greatest individuals of all time. Stalin came out on top with 38%, while Putin shared second place with 34%, and then, of course, the poet Pushkin was tied with Vladimir Putin. Revolutionary Vladimir Lenin, Tsar Peter the Great, and the first man in space, Yuri Gagarin, came next in the list of 20 people, with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev in last place.
Oh,
come on. 6%. The list includes famed statesmen, writers, and scientists, but only three foreigners, Napoleon, Albert Einstein, and Isaac Newton. So the Russians asked, who are the greatest people of all time? I said, I think it's probably Stalin. Now, Stalin killed millions of his own people. This is a little bit of a write-up here from Stanford. Stalin killed millions. A Stanford historian answers the question, was it genocide? They're talking about this book where historian Norman Neymark argues about Stalin that he committed genocide, which, of course, he did. They say Stalin had nearly a million of his own citizens executed beginning in the 1930s. Millions more fell victim to forced labor, deportation, famine, massacres, and detention and interrogation by Stalin's henchmen. None of this is a surprise. I mean, everybody knows this happened. It's pretty obvious history. But yet they still look at that guy and they say, yeah, he was great. And they say there's a reason for Russian obliviousness when it comes to thinking about Stalin or somebody like that. They say every family had not only victims but perpetrators. A vast network of state organizations had to be mobilized to seize and kill that many people. So Russia's got sort of this odd thinking about Stalin, because even though he killed their families, a lot of their families also helped kill their families.
And that's why they're still alive.
They're conflicted. Yeah.
They were on the side. They were on Stalin's good side. And so it would make sense that maybe they liked him a little bit more. And you can also see by that list, almost all of them are Russians. They are a nationalistic people, even though they've had a pretty rough history for the most part. Stalin presided over a time when they were a formidable empire. Gorbachev basically presided over the collapse of the empire. Even though it was an oppressive empire, they were not looked on as a great power in the world anymore, and so they didn't like him as much.
Yeah, it really shows the Russian thinking. It's very different than what we would think about here in the West. Well, I should say for the most part, or used to be. They say, how much can the author about this, Stalin, well, the Stalin author, he says, how much can you move on? Can you put in your past? How is a national identity formed when a central part of it is a crime? So it is hard for them to move on and say that was bad because they were part of it. It was great crimes, but yet they historically, a lot of the people have been part of it themselves. There's one example given here, and of course we all know a lot of atrocities were committed in Russia, but it says the Soviet elimination of a social class, the kulaks, who were higher income farmers, and the subsequent killer famine among all Ukrainian peasants was notorious. It called for the mass execution and exile of socially harmful elements as enemies of the people. 30,000 kulaks were killed directly, mostly shot on the spot. About 2 million were forcibly deported to the far north and Siberia. They were called enemies of the people, as well as swine, dogs, cockroaches, scum, vermin, filth, garbage, half-animals, apes. They didn't like them. Activists promoted murderous slogans. We will exile the kulak by the thousand when necessary. Shoot the kulak breed. We will make soap of kulaks. Our class enemies must be wiped off the face of the earth. That was all under Stalin's leadership there in Russia.
Not a good time. That's really, people need to take a look at that. But of course, a lot of them have also been raised with sort of a hostility toward America or a lot of the West in general. And so when America stands for freedom and you don't like America, then you're not necessarily going to be a fan of people like Gorbachev, who sort of were too friendly with America.
Yeah, I mean, this history is so fascinating. Just thinking back to that story from The Spectator about that professor that says Otto Warmbier got what he deserved. What does she think about the kulaks? Did they get what they deserved? I mean, you can look at so many groups of people or individuals in history that died at the hands of these murderous regimes. Did they get what they deserved? Is that the thinking now? Oh, well, I mean, yeah, they made Stalin upset. Therefore, you get what you deserve.
Yeah, she clearly doesn't understand that no human has a right to take another human life. And so she's clueless about what's going on pretty much throughout history and even up to this point. Russian history is actually extremely intriguing just because we can't relate to living in that kind of environment of fear and terror and wondering if someone across the street who doesn't like us very much might falsely report us to the government and turn us in just because there's a grudge there. That's the type of atmosphere that those Russian people had to deal with. But at the same time, they got really tough. They put their heads down, they worked hard, and they were not big complainers. There are some admirable traits there that they have developed just because of the torture that they've been through.
Yeah. I mean, once they get going the right way as people, they're going to do amazing things, but they just always are under these dictatorial leaders like a Stalin. But they still say, hey, we think he was great. Stalin tops Putin in Russian poll of greatest historical figures. Every time you see a poll like that, I guess I always tend to wonder, like, if they have to fill it in under threat of, imprisonment or something. But it does seem like they actually do look to it. And we've talked about this history a little bit before. I think Abraham made the point that you brought out here again that, they were considered a national power at the time. So they were happy with that. They want to have that high ranking. So Vladimir Putin's got some work to do.
Well, do you think they have true education over there? Do you think that their schools are teaching them any sort of true history if they still to this day believe that Joseph Stalin was such a heroic figure? They're not learning the evils they've done because really, realistically, it's difficult to acknowledge that your nation has been evil for a large part of its history.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely different. They would have a different history class than they would probably have over here. Although, that might be changing. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. And make sure you listen for the Key of David program and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Also, Just the Best Literature coming up. For myself, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon, thanks for spending some time with us on this Monday. Enjoy the rest of your day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.